Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you back again. We had a nice little break during the Advent, but it's always fun to get back together. We're starting the new series today, and this is our first session on what I'm calling our covenant relationships. We have three goals for today. I'm going to present the concept of covenant. We're going to talk about the typical covenant elements and briefly examine the covenants we're going to be covering in this series. And this will be almost entirely lecture today, for which I apologize, because I want to lay a very solid foundation, but use only one session to do so. Okay, so I'm going to move very quickly. So let's begin, shall we? May the Lord bless our studies this morning. Most Americans seem to think that a covenant is a contract or a part of one. In our American legal system, a covenant is a promise in a written contract or deed, such as use of an easement for real estate or something like that. We have homeowners association covenants that are promises to respect the rules of conduct or the use of the property, the limitations on construction, and all that kind of stuff. But the concept we have in Western culture of a covenant is not the same as the concept in Eastern cultures or in the Bible. So from now on in this study, all references to covenant will be to the biblical covenant. Okay? We're not talking about homeowners association covenants or easement covenants or anything like that. We're talking about biblical concept of covenants. A covenant is not a contract. They look very similar, but they have some very important differences. So on your worksheet there, I gave you a chart showing some similarities between a contract and covenant. Contract and covenant, both are legal agreements which define relationships. Both have terms or lists of expectations. Both have blessings or benefits for adhering to those terms. Both have curses or penalties for violating those terms. Both require all parties involved to affirm the covenant, and both may require legal witnesses. So although contracts and covenants may look very similar on the surface, the underlying motivation of a covenant is the exact opposite of that of a contract. Exactly the opposite. And the next chart I have there on your worksheet shows the contrasts, the differences between the contract and covenant. A contract defines a potentially adversarial or hostile relationship. A covenant defines a loving relationship. In a contract, each party focuses on their self-interests, and they try to maximize their own benefits within the contractual terms, trying to get the most they can out of that contract. In a covenant, here's the key difference. Each party is fully committed to the other's success and well-being within the covenant terms. Totally different focus. In a contract, specifies protection of each party from the other to prevent abuse or harm. Covenant, on the other hand, in a covenant, protection of each party from the other is unnecessary because they're fully committed to each other. A contract defines a conditional relationship based on performance. As long as you do this, then our relationship continues. In a covenant, however, a covenant defines an unconditional, enduring relationship. A contract can be changed or even canceled, but a covenant is a binding, unbreakable obligation between two parties, and it's breakable only by death. In other words, when you enter into covenant, you're in covenant with that person or party until one of you passes away. In a contract, exchanging property or service is the primary importance. That's what it's all about. For example, it might specify payment in exchange for a product or service. Okay? That's typical of a contract. In a covenant, however, there is exchanging of abilities and resources, but that's secondary importance. In fact, it's almost way down the list, so to speak. And we'll see that in the blessings of the covenant. A contract is sealed by a promise in which each gives his word or signature. And in a covenant, is sealed by oath, usually by the name of God. And that's the highest oath you can take. We don't have a good example of covenants in our modern Western culture here. In fact, in reality, marriage is a covenant, but since we view marriage as a contract, divorce is prevalent. So marriage is not a good example in our culture of covenant, although it really is a covenant. The Bible is a covenant book. That's really what it's all about, and it's in two parts. It has Old Testament and New Testament. The word testament comes from the Greek word, which is a concept of covenant, and that word is translated covenant or testament or will. The Old Testament in the Bible contains descriptions of the old covenants. The New Testament describes a description of the new covenant. So covenant is very dominant in who we are as Christians. In fact, God initiates every covenant he makes with man. We cannot initiate covenant with God. He does that. And we can only accept or reject the covenant in its entirety. God clearly is superior to us. And making covenant does not make us equal with him. He's still superior with us, even though he enters covenant with us. Man is the pinnacle of God's creation. And God created only man in his image. He created us to be like him, to rule with him eventually, to be his peer in a limited sense, as much as a created being can be a peer with the creator. That's what God created us to be. And God lovingly comes down to our level, if you can put it that way, to honor us by dealing with us more or less as his equal. And he does this by offering to make covenant with us. And once we accept the covenant, if we then try to interpret the covenant in our own way, we create serious problems in our relationship with God. We're trying to take what he has specified and make it work to our advantage. And you really can't do that. Now, this is not to suggest that if we do that, if we misuse our covenant with God, that he gets angry with us or punishes us. I'm kind of ad-libbing here. I'm not back to your worksheet again yet. So just give me a moment. I'll be back to it. This doesn't suggest that God is angry with us or he tries to punish us or anything like that when we don't adhere to his covenant strictly. Rather, he tends to withdraw some of his promises and blessings from us temporarily to allow us to experience the consequences of our choices. And he does that only out of love for us, to try to encourage us to return to him. And then he honors us by accepting our choices. If we choose to return to him, he honors that. If we choose not to return to him, he honors that choice. He tries to persuade us, but the choice is ours, and he honors our choice. Our relationship with God is based on covenant. And we will only understand that relationship when we understand what covenants are and how they work. In fact, the fact that we don't understand covenants is obvious. Let me give you some examples. Many, if not most of us, have actually taken the Lord's name in vain. We call ourselves Christians and continue to act like the world. That's one evidence that we don't understand covenants. Another is that our families and friendships are falling apart. Another, our divorce rate as Christians is virtually identical to that of the secular world. There's no difference. And moral failure among Christians is common. I see these as evidences that we really don't understand covenant. If we understood and honored covenants, we would be shining examples of the absolute supremacy of God's ways. Unfortunately, we're not. So I believe that this study of covenants is absolutely central for us. Now, the covenants we're going to consider in this study are shown on your worksheet, and we'll go through those one at a time. And you're going to see a lot of Old Testament covenants in this list. We have three basic reasons for studying Old Testament covenants. Number one, to familiarize ourselves with the concept of covenants, to see what they look like in other situations, to gain a clear understanding of how they work, what they do, how they work, and to understand the life-changing impact of our covenant relationships. I emphasize life-changing. On your list, your worksheet there, you have a list of the typical covenant elements. I simply put them there to show you the type of topics we're going to be covering in this study. Each covenant typically has a vow or an oath that seals or guarantees the covenant, and usually that's part of the statement of terms or blessings. It often is not separated as a separate part. You see it embedded in other parts of the covenant. Terms express the purpose of the covenant, its nature, or the scope, that is, how much it covers. Exchanging of coats represents giving of self or shared identity. The exchanging of belt and weapons, that represents the pledging of strength, support, abilities, and protection. Typically exchange portion of names. That represents, again, shared identity, also shared authority. In the older secular covenants, we won't see much of this in our Bible study, but typically in secular covenants, they would cut flesh, mix blood, and fix a permanent scar. And we have representations of that in our covenants. This was a sign of unity and was proof of covenant. They would pronounce blessing for adhering to the terms, and this includes revealing their possessions. Part of the blessing was everything that's mine is now yours. That was part of the blessings. They would pronounce curses for violating the covenant. They would prepare a meal and exchange food, and that represents the care and provision that each would provide for the other. They would sacrifice an animal and cut it in half and walk between them. That was called the walk of death. And it represents death to self or death to individualism. In other words, if we separate, we're going to be like this dead carcass here. All right. When we're together, we're alive. When we separate, we're dead. It included descendants, typically. And they typically set up a memorial, which was a visual reminder of that covenant. Yeah, these are the typical elements of covenants, and they don't appear in every covenant. They are typical. And our plan is to examine one covenant element each session. And we'll look at all the covenants as they relate to that particular element. And I'm going to do that to help us understand the significance of each element in our covenant. That way we'll have something from every session to take home with us, some new insight that we've gained. A few key words here, actually a couple key words. The word covenant in the Old Testament is from a Hebrew word. I give it to you there. It's pronounced berit. This is the defining word that we'll see in every Old Testament covenant. In the New Testament, the word covenant is from the Greek word diatheke. And we'll see that in the New Testament. So every place we're looking in the Old Testament, we'll see the Hebrew word berit. And every place in the New Testament, we'll see the Greek word diatheke. Okay, that's what this is all about. Any questions or observations from this point? Let's begin with the first covenant, God's covenant with Adam and Eve. This is the very first covenant in the Bible, even though the word covenant does not appear in the Genesis text where we see Adam and Eve. But if we look in Hosea 6:7, we see this. It says, like Adam, they have broken the covenant. And the covenant there is the Hebrew word berit. When we look at the book of Genesis, we'll see that it contains a lot of covenant language and identifies several covenant elements. And some of those covenant elements in Genesis with Adam and Eve are rather indirect because their direct application was not relevant at that time. Okay? But we'll still see hints of them. Now, this covenant with Adam and Eve is unique. God made it with Adam and Eve before they were affected by sin, before they sinned. So in that sense, it reveals something about God's highest purpose for man. Okay? Going back to expectations again, right. Yep. So since God made this covenant with Adam and Eve before they sinned, it gives us unique insight into God's expectations of their relationship with them. Okay? So God initiated this covenant unilaterally and required only obedience from Adam. Then we'll look at at God's covenant with Noah. God initiated this covenant and specified all of its effects after the flood. And I gave you background there, Genesis 6, 1 through 9. I'd like for you to step down towards the end of that section there, where it says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Do you see that? It says, this is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among all the people of his time, and he walked with God. Based on what I just read to you, why do you think God made covenant with Noah? It says Noah found what?
Favor
with the Lord. That's right. And then the last statement there that I quoted shows three points. Probably the reasons he found favor with the Lord. He was a righteous man, right? And that means he was upright or just in his relationship with God and other people. It says he was blameless, which means that he had innocent character. He was morally innocent in his character. There was no moral defect. Now, this doesn't mean that Noah was sinless, because Adam's failure caused all humans to become sinners. You with me on that? So the fact that Noah was a sinner by birth, yet he conformed to God's standard, and therefore God called him blameless. That's how that worked. You follow me?
Like confessing his sins and so forth.
Whatever that looked like. It doesn't really specify. It just simply says that he was blameless. It also says that he walked with God. Now, the Bible only says this with two people.
He and
Abraham.
Enoch.
Yeah.
Walked with God and he was not.
That's right. Bible only says, specifically states that two people walked with God, Enoch and Noah. This suggests an awareness of God and a desire to avoid offending him, I suppose. That kind of thing. And to know him, yes. Now, if you look there on your worksheet, Genesis 6, 17 through 18, this is God speaking to Noah, and he says, I'm going to bring the floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has a breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant, Hebrew word berit. I will establish my berit with you, and you will enter the ark. This is the first occurrence of the word berit in the Bible, in Genesis 6. Notice that God says, I will establish my covenant with you. That's future tense, isn't it? That means he's not doing it at that point, right? He's going to do it sometime in the future. I will establish my covenant with you. He actually established the covenant after the flood.
When he made the altar and set up the altar.
It was in that time period, yes. But when he's speaking to him right here is actually before the flood, because you see he says, I'm going to bring flood waters on the earth. And then he says, I will establish my covenant with you. And it turns out that is after the flood. But even though he didn't establish the covenant until after the flood, we still see some of the covenant elements that were invoked prior to the flood. You see some of the things that God said he was going to do. For example, he said, you're going to enter my ark. And he explained other things to him. So we see some hint that a covenant is coming, and actually God is already bringing in some of the provisions of covenant to him before he actually made covenant with him. So this shows that God made covenant with Noah. All I'm trying to do today is to demonstrate that God made covenant with these people. And therefore, these are the people we're going to study. We're going to study their covenant relationships. So I'm just setting a base today, a foundation that says, yes, God established covenant with these people. Let's consider God's covenant with Abraham. In our scriptures, we're going to see references to both Abram and Abraham, because the covenant included a name change. Before covenant, this man was called Abram. That was his given name. And God changed his name when making covenant with him, so he was called Abraham. And we'll look at that in detail in a future session. The covenant with Abram was initially described in very broad outline in general in Genesis chapter 12, then actually established the covenant later and explained it in greater detail. Look at Genesis 15, starting in verse 18 there. On that day the Lord made covenant with Abram. This is when he actually made the covenant. And he said, to your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river of the Euphrates, to the land of all the Ites. He's specifying here that land is a key part of this covenant, is he not?
Yes.
To your descendants I give this land. And I want to point out something here, it's kind of a side note, that when it refers to the river of Egypt, it's not talking about the Nile. It's interpreted to mean the Wadi al-Arish, which has been referred to locally as the river of Egypt. That's a wadi that starts off the southern portion of Gaza on the Mediterranean and goes south-southeast from there. If you know the map of Israel, you know that it comes down the Mediterranean, goes down, and then it takes a sharp slant down. Right where it starts down right there is what's called the Wadi al-Arish, which typically was called the River of Egypt. All right. If you look in Scripture, you'll find out in the Old Testament that quite often the Sinai Peninsula, which was south of that area, was actually called part of Egypt. So, when he talks about the land, he's referring to everything from Gaza to the River Euphrates, which I think is very significant, and we'll possibly look at that a little bit later. Again, the word covenant here is from the Hebrew word berit. And notice here a couple of things that God pledged Abram would have descendants. Now, when God spoke this to him, Abram and Sarai were very old, and she was barren. They did not have any children. But yet God says, you're going to have descendants. And notice also God pledged the land to Abram. Today we call that land Israel. Now, this covenant was virtually unconditional towards Abram. All he had to do was be circumcised to establish the covenant. That's all that was required of Abram. The covenant with Abram, as we will see, is eternal and it's irrevocable. That's very significant. In fact, actually, this covenant with Abraham, as we call him, served as kind of an umbrella for covenants that God would later make with his descendants, and that includes us. So the question then is, why did God make covenant with Abram? Well, in Genesis 18:19, God is speaking of Abram, and he says, I have chosen him. So God sovereignly chose Abram because he saw an important quality in the man. And those qualities we're very familiar with. We saw that Abram would believe God and obey him. He believed God and was counted to him as righteousness, right? That is the characteristic that we identify with Abram, or Abraham. Abraham's faith is the quality most frequently cited in Scripture, and in fact, it was the primary reason I believe God chose him.
You might say his relationship or his desire for God was similar to Noah's. He was singled out as a man that was seeking God's favor.
And was unique. Yes, he was seeking God's favor and he was unique. The New Testament calls us, Christians, descendants of Abraham. And faith is a prerequisite for our relationship with God too. Just like Abraham. Okay? So that was his dominant characteristic that Scripture highlights. And it's a requirement for us as well. Now, another little point here. James 2:23 states that Abraham was called God's friend. Now, that word friend there is not buddy, like we call friends. It uses the word friend to describe a covenant partner, what is sometimes called a blood brother. And they're called blood brothers usually because they would mix blood. Okay, blood was a vital part of making covenant. The word friend is philos, and it's someone who is the object of family-like affection. Okay? It's someone who has the object of family-like affection. It's much stronger than our use of the word friend, which can mean a casual acquaintance. So the point here is simply to make that God made covenant with Abram or Abraham. I think as we go through and identify these covenants, you're going to see why the Bible spends so much time talking about these people. It's because God made covenant with them. Let's look briefly at God's first covenant with Israel. God told Abraham that his descendants would be in a foreign land for 400 years, and that he would lead them to the land he had showed Abram. You know, he said, your descendants will occupy this land. He would lead them to that land. Now, Abraham's son was Isaac. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the three generations? So Abraham's grandson was Jacob, whom God later renamed what?
Israel,
that's right. So Jacob, or Israel's entire family, went to Egypt because of a famine. Remember that? The story about Joseph and all that? Okay. And over the next 400 years, they became slaves. And they cried out to God for deliverance. And God assigned Moses to lead them out of Egypt. You familiar with the story? The Exodus and all that? Okay. Now I want to draw your attention to Exodus 19, verses 3 through 6. This is after the showdown between Moses and Pharaoh and Passover, and God, through Moses, led the Israelites out of Egypt into the wilderness to Mount Sinai, what we call Mount Sinai. And here we find them here in Exodus 19. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on the eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, what's the Hebrew word here? Berit. Covenant, Hebrew word, berit. If you obey me fully, you notice that's conditional. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. Now, they're at Sinai here, Mount Sinai, about 3 months after the Israelites left Egypt. And this is the covenant that God made with Israel through Moses. This often is called the Mosaic Covenant, but it wasn't a covenant with Moses. It was a covenant with Israel through Moses. And it's the most detailed covenant in the entire Old Testament. It's a beautiful type of new covenant, what we call the New Testament. It's full of symbolic hints of the new covenant, which are called shadows, and it includes the law. And the purpose of the law was severalfold. First of all, it makes us conscious of sin. We're talking about the Mosaic law, the law God gave Israel under Moses. It makes us conscious of sin, according to the New Testament. It shows a need for a Savior, because we can't become righteous under the law, so we're unable to do what God requires, right? It shows that we need a Savior. And it shows people how to conduct themselves until the Messiah came. Now, as I pointed out, this covenant was conditional. There are a lot of if-then statements. If you obey me, then this will happen. Now, we know today that Israel broke that covenant. They violated the covenant. They came under the curses. Yet this covenant very clearly states that God will never totally forsake Israel. That's an important point. He stated that knowing that they would violate its covenant. He would never fully forsake them. The books of Leviticus, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, the books of Leviticus and Numbers provide the details of the covenant. All right, we see the covenant being made in Exodus, but the next two books, Leviticus and Numbers, actually explain all the workings and details of the covenant, even though some of them are given in the book of Exodus. So why did God make a covenant with Israel? Israel was a nation that descended from Abraham's grandson, Jacob. So the covenant with Israel was a result of God's covenant with Abraham. Do you see that? Okay. God chose them to be his people. He knew what kind of people they were going to be. He knew what they were going to do, but he chose them sovereignly to be his people. Deuteronomy 7:6 I have for you there. It says, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession." His people. That implies a unique relationship as a result of their covenant. It was God's sovereign choice. It's not because they deserved it, as we well know. But then again, that's always the case in covenants with God. God sovereignly... Exactly right. That was the point. God sovereignly chooses, even though we don't deserve it. Now, you know the story about the Exodus. Israel was afraid to enter the Promised Land, as God told them. So he led them around in the wilderness for 40 years until the entire first generation died. You remember that?
Yeah.
At the end of the 40 years, God made a second covenant with Israel. He made it with the second generation. The first generation had passed away. And God's second covenant with Israel is closely related to the covenant he made with the first generation. It's closely related. In fact, a lot of people consider the second covenant actual renewal of the first covenant with the new generation. But I think it's very clear that this is a separate covenant, and I'll show you why. In fact, there in Deuteronomy 29:1, it says, "These are the terms of the covenant," this is the second covenant, "that the Lord commanded Moses to make with the Israelites in Moab, in addition to the covenant he made with them at Mount Sinai." Okay? The word covenant here is the Hebrew word what?
Berit.
That's right. You guys are getting good at this. Now, why did God make this covenant? Well, basically for the same reasons he made the first covenant. But it states that this is in addition to the first covenant God made with Israel when they left Egypt. And it clearly distinguishes it from the first covenant. The first covenant through Moses is described in the book of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. All right? Now, this second covenant is described in Deuteronomy. That's why if you read through the first five books of the Bible, you're going to think, oh, it's just still saying the same thing over and over and over again. You see it in Exodus, you see it elaborated in Leviticus and Numbers, and then you come back again in Deuteronomy saying, exactly, what's the point? Well, it's because there are two different covenants. And what he's showing is that this second covenant is almost identical to the first covenant, but there is a very significant difference. There's a major difference from the first covenant. The second covenant gives laws for the land, and it gives them in detail. This was when they were about to enter the land. It's almost like God knew that the first generation wasn't going to go into the land, so he didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about it. All right? You follow me?
How waste his breath.
Yeah, right? Why waste his breath, right? If God can waste his breath. But in the second covenant here, the one where the second generation was about to enter the Promised Land, God gives some very elaborate and specific details about the land. How they were to take it, how they were to divide it up, the cities of refuge, all that kind of stuff is detailed in the book of Deuteronomy. This second covenant with Israel, I suggest to you, is the most politically significant covenant God has made with Israel because it establishes Israel's right to the land. Now, when our politicians are involved in the Middle East and fail to recognize or to acknowledge Israel's God-given right to the land, they jeopardize our national well-being. We've talked about this in previous sessions because the way America treats Israel determines what's going to happen in America. That's right. So, This second covenant with Israel here was very important because it clearly established Israel's right to the land. So God made covenant with Israel, actually twice. Let's look now at David and Jonathan's covenant. Who, first of all, were David and Jonathan? Well, Jonathan was the son of King Saul, who was the first king of Israel. Remember that? Okay. And David was a shepherd. So we have a prince, the son of a king, and a shepherd who was a who lived with his father and brothers in Bethlehem, a tiny little town out in the boonies, you know. So almost from opposite ends of the spectrum here, almost. David became King Saul's minstrel. Then he became a successful military leader, which led to him becoming a fugitive, because King Saul tried to kill him because he was more popular with the people than the king was. Look in 1 Samuel 18, 3 and 4. Again, we're talking about the covenant between David and Jonathan. And Jonathan made a covenant. Hebrew word what?
Berit.
Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off his robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. But these two young men had such love and respect for each other that they made covenant. And later in this study, you're going to see the significance of Jonathan giving David his robe, his tunic, his sword, and his belt. This is a beautiful story that God's preserved for us in the Bible. And I think in part to reveal David's character, to show who he always was, even as a young man. And as many times as I've taught covenants, and it's been many times, this story right here touches me the most out of all the rest. It's a fabulous story. The account of David and Jonathan and then Mephibosheth is a fantastic story. This is the covenant between David and Jonathan. And the Bible describes several other covenants. This is not a covenant that God made with a human. Rather, this is a covenant between two men. The Bible describes several other covenants between men that don't necessarily directly include God. But this is the only one we're going to examine because it is extraordinary. This is a special covenant here. It's a beautiful story. Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't wait till we get into it because it's a beautiful story. Let's consider the covenant that God made with David, which was after this one. This is the covenant that God made with David after the death of King Saul. You don't see a direct statement where God is saying, I make covenant with you, but you see some indirect references to it here that I provided for you. In Psalm 89:3, David wrote this psalm, of course, and he said, you said, referring to God, I have made a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David, my servant. So David here is referring to the statement that God made. You follow me? Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's quoting God. And God says, I am making covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David, my servant. And 2 Samuel 23:5, this is David near the end of his life. He says, is not my house right with God? Has he not made me an everlasting covenant, arranged and secured in every part? See, this is a covenant that God made with David, not Israel, with David, the king. So it applies only to him and his descendants. This does not overlap or interfere with or supersede God's covenant with Israel. This is separate. So why did God make covenant with David? Well, think of what the Bible says about David. He had a heart for God. And we know that God says he became the standard for all other kings of Israel. Repeatedly, throughout the generations, the other kings of Israel and Judah, God says he did right according to his father David, his ancestor David, or he didn't follow the Lord as his father David did. So David became the standard. He became the benchmark for all others. And I say that this is an eternal covenant because God says elsewhere, you will always have a descendant on the throne of Israel. Now, we have to decide whether that means he will always, as in contiguous kingships, will always be the lineage of David. No, we know that there were always kings sitting on the throne. I think possibly that means otherwise, you will have a king on the throne forever.
Sets up the lordship of Jesus to come.
Exactly. And Jesus will rule Israel. So, David had a heart for God and became the standard for all of the kings in Israel. We see other characteristics of David. He was courageous. He had integrity. He set standards for worshiping God. He wrote many of the Psalms. So it was to him, to David, that God made the final covenant of the Old Testament era. And I think that's significant. I mean, this supersedes everything else that preceded it, except for the covenant with Israel. Well, and the covenant with Abraham. But this is such an important and vital covenant that it is the final one that God made in the Old Testament era. And the very next covenant would be the new covenant. Okay, God's covenant with Abraham was extraordinary. Like the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with David had profound impact on history and will have effect on the future as well. God's covenants with Abraham and David are irrevocable. That means they're not dependent upon man's faithfulness. That's significant. Abraham and David. The covenant with Abraham said that all his descendants will be blessed. That includes Israel and us Christians. The covenant with David said that he will have a descendant on the throne of Israel forever. And we've already stated that was Jesus. These two covenants stand as beautiful examples of God's sovereign choice to make covenant with men, to express the fullness of his nature to them as individuals, and to influence all of human history through those covenants. These are fantastic covenants. Let's look at God's covenant with Christians. Luke 22:20. How are we doing on time? Oh, good. Luke 22:20 is what we call the Last Supper.
Excuse me, very briefly. Jeff? What element of today's Israel would recognize these covenants the greatest?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Which element of today's religious Jews in Israel would acknowledge and recognize this covenant, these covenants the most?
Well, certainly not the secular Jews. They're Jewish by culture, just like a lot of Christians are Christians by culture. I don't know the names of Sephardic and all the other types of Judaism, but certainly the Orthodox Jews may be most likely to acknowledge that. I'm not sure. But there are a lot of Jews who call themselves Jews, who are Jews by birth, who really do not acknowledge that. In fact, you'll see this in the Israeli papers, newspapers, and comments, and so forth. A lot of Israelis are saying, "Let's give up the land. You know, let's buy peace." So they're willing to do that. In fact, that's a very strong push over there. We want peace. We're willing to give up land. They don't realize that would be committing suicide, basically. But so a lot of Jews by birth and also Jews by practice, don't acknowledge the right to the land. Okay. Let's look now at God's covenant with Christians. Again, going back to the Last Supper, Luke 22:20. In the same way, this is Jesus speaking, in the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." Now, the word that's translated covenant here is the Greek word diatheke, and it means covenant, testament, or will. And the New Testament of the Bible is literally the New Covenant. And it's called the New Covenant because it supersedes all that went before it. Now, our entire relationship with God is based on this New Covenant. It includes salvation, justification, righteousness, sanctification, holiness, and everything else. Here's an important point about this covenant, however. God does not make the New Covenant with us as individuals. What? Aren't we in a covenant relationship? Yes, we are. But God... this covenant is a covenant between God the Father and God the Son, Jesus, the Son of Man. The Father guarantees the divine side of the covenant, and Jesus, the Son of Man, guarantees the human side of the covenant. So it's unconditional. This covenant is unconditional because God the Father and God the Son said, "This is the covenant," and they guaranteed it. Now, the covenant applies to us as we believe on the Lord Jesus and accept what he's done for us. We can, however, choose to violate it and receive its curses. This doesn't negate the covenant, only how the covenant applies to us. You follow me? If I blow it and turn my back on God and walk away from him, I haven't broken the covenant. I have severed myself from it. The covenant continues because it's between God the Father and the Son of Man, Jesus. So it's an unconditional covenant. The main purpose of this covenant is to restore man to relationship with God, which he did through Jesus, the man. It would be easy to conclude that our mutual covenant, each of us has a covenant with God, that it would be easy to conclude that that mutual covenant with God places each of us in covenant relationship with each other. I'm certain it does. In fact, I'm positive it does. But I'm not going to make I don't plan to make that a major point in the study. I do believe, however, that as you learn to honor your covenant relationship with God, it'll become very natural to honor your relationship with other Christians, with all other Christians, whether they believe the way you do or not. All right, let's look at God's new covenant with Israel. Jeremiah 31:31, a very brief excerpt from Jeremiah 31, which is very relevant. Just verse 31, however, says, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." What do you suppose the word covenant there is in Hebrew? Berit. You see a pattern here? Yeah. Do I believe in replacement theology that the church has taken Israel's place? No, absolutely not. There are some people who claim that God has abandoned the Jews and substituted the church. I suggest they read the New Testament. They need to read Romans, Hebrews, Galatians, Ephesians, and Colossians. Because it shows that the saints are here. The saints are heirs together with Israel. It talks about the mystery of Christ. That is, the Gentiles are included in God's new covenant with Israel. That's the mystery of Christ. You see, Israel has always been the center of God's attention and always will be. It's based on his covenant with Abraham, which he said he will never violate. Okay? When God says never, he means never, ever, ever. Never, ever, ever. The new covenant with Israel will be earth-based, as were the original covenants that are described in the Old Testament. God's physical creation, God created the physical universe for his prized possession, which is who?
His people.
His people, or mankind, humanity. Physical creation is man's domain, and man will always rule it. Jesus, the man, will eventually rule it. Our role in this eternal covenant includes, as Christians, includes spiritual aspects as well as earthly aspects, and because we will eventually rule with Christ. Simply to show that there is a new covenant pending with Israel. Let's look now at the marriage covenant. This is the last covenant we'll look at in the series. Malachi 2:14. "It is because the Lord is acting as a witness between you and the wife of your youth, because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant." The word for covenant in Hebrew here is berit. It's the same Hebrew word that's used in every other covenant in the Old Testament. God created marriage and he defined it as a covenant. Therefore, it is a covenant, regardless of what we think about it. We might think of it as just a relationship or as a contract. We can negotiate and nullify whenever we want to, but God says, no, it's covenant. It is covenant. The New Testament treats marriage or reflects marriage's covenant status. So, let me bring things to a close here. For several months as I was preparing this series, I was calling it our covenant relationship with God. And just a couple of days ago, the emphasis was going to be on our covenant relationship with God. But I was going to include the covenant with David and Jonathan, and also the marriage covenant. But 2 days ago, it became very clear to me that I was supposed to change the name of the series to Our Covenant Relationships, plural. Because we need teaching on our covenants with God and our spouses. So that's why I'm shifting the emphasis at this stage. Today, we presented the concept of covenant. We identified typical elements of covenant. We briefly examined the covenants that we'll study in this series. I wanted to show you very clearly that these are covenants we're talking about here with each of these individuals and with Israel. I apologize for making almost all of this lecture today. This was introductory. I wanted to cover a lot of territory. I didn't want to spend more than one session. I wanted to get it all packed in there. So I packed, and pushed, and got it all in. Next week, we're going to look at one of the covenant elements as it applies to all the covenants we're studying. And this will start making all this come alive. This is really going to come to life for you. Before we leave, I'd like to pronounce a blessing for you, or blessing over you. May you begin to see the magnitude of God's love for you, how fully committed he is to your well-being, and how he has honored you by entering into unconditional and unbreakable covenant with you. The Lord bless you. It was great to see you today. Look forward to seeing you next week. You may leave now if you want. We have a few minutes to spare if you have any questions or comments. Anybody have any questions about what we covered so far? Or are you just sitting there with your tongue hanging out saying, whew. Yeah. Jim?
The new idea that you put out, the covenant was between God the Father and God the Son.
Yes.
That was a new take that I had not quite seen before.
Right.
That's good. And it applies to us because we believe on the Lord Jesus Christ.
Right.
Accepting what he has done for us.
I might remind you that the Bible, excuse me, the New Testament refers to Jesus as the firstborn of many. We talked about that several times. He was the Son of Man. That's what he called himself. He was human. He was fully human. And he, as fully human, made covenant with God the Father. So he, representing the entire human race, in essence, made covenant. And neither he nor God will break that covenant. So it's an eternal, unbreakable, unconditional covenant because it's been made between a perfect God and a perfect man. Okay? So it cannot be violated. It cannot be broken. So it really is between God the Father and the Son of Man, Jesus, God the Son. Okay?
Somehow I missed that. But
yeah. Well, I had too for a long time.
Saying that he was perfect, then I'm surely not, gives me a great deal of relief.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And the fact that that covenant is unconditional. It's not a performance-based covenant. You'll be my child as long as you adhere to this list of demands. It's unconditional. But yet we still choose to engage in it. Okay? Lord bless you. It was great to be with you again after a break from Advent and the holiday seasons. I'm looking forward to this series.